From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
What comes after the Great Recession? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Great Recession is not economics as usual, but the beginning of a historic transformation. That's according to some long-term thinkers. They say arguing over the stimulus and the deficit is the wrong conversation, based on the past instead of the future. But what will the future require? As the manufacturing economy is replaced by the knowledge economy, where will the next middle class come from? Will green industry generate jobs? Will home ownership still be relevant? Can government liberate creative entrepreneurs and encourage economic equality at the same time? On Reporter's Notebook later on, interest rates on credit cards. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. President Obama tries to be optimistic, but concedes that the Great Recession won't go away fast. Others compare it to the Great Depression as a signal of momentous economic change. We'll hear some challenging opinions today about how American lives might be changing, too. On Reporter's Notebook, finance reform was supposed to provide new consumer protections, so why are interest rates on credit cards going up when rates on other borrowing are going down? First, this news update. The Obama White House says today that even George W. Bush's limited guidelines for stem cell research might be overturned by yesterday's judicial ruling in Washington. Judge Royce Lamberth ordered that all federal spending on research involving destruction of human embryos come to an immediate end. Karen Kaplan reports for the Los Angeles Times. Karen, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
The Obama guidelines do not allow for the actual destruction of embryos, do not allow federal money to be spent for that purpose. Why isn't that good enough for the judge?
Well, in fact, that seems to be the key question. Since 1999, the NIH has made clear that it views the experiments that are needed to turn the embryos into embryonic stem cells as clearly off-limits for federal funding, but that subsequently you can use those embryonic stem cells as tools in other research, and that's separate from the destruction of the embryos. And that's been their argument all along. That's what the Department of Health and Human Services argued in court. And the judge said he didn't buy that the whole, all that research is along one continuum, and you can't use human embryonic stem cells as a research tool without having destroyed an embryo. So that was in violation of a law called the Dickey Wicker Amendment.
Okay. Who were the people who brought suit, and what damage did they assert was occurring to them because of what the federal government was doing?
There were originally a whole group of plaintiffs. Most of them got thrown off the case for what they call lack of standing, that they didn't really have a good dog in the fight. But the two that were allowed to remain are scientists who study adult stem cells. And those are stem cells taken from tissues from people who are already born, kids, babies, grown-ups. But it doesn't involve destruction of a human embryo. And they have been very clear in saying they work with adult stem cells specifically because they're morally opposed to research on embryonic stem cells. They had standing in this case because they said once the Obama guidelines went into effect, now they have to compete with a whole bunch more scientists in order to get NIH grant money, which is relatively scarce, and that's how they would be harmed by allowing this policy to go forward.
So two issues involved for them then. First of all, the economic competition, which I gather is what got them into court, and then
right.
Their moral opposition to this. And this goes back, of course, to the argument about abortion.
Right, and it also goes back to the Bush administration stem cell policy. This is one thing that's a little confusing among many, but President George W. Bush was actually the first president to allow the NIH to fund any research at all using human embryonic stem cells. And if you read the argument that these plaintiffs made, you know, one would think that it would apply, you know, they could have filed a suit in August 2001 after the Bush policy went into effect and made the same argument.
What does this mean for researchers now engaged in stem cell activity, particularly in California, where there's an enormous amount of public money devoted to it?
Well, anybody who's got NIH money and is using it to work on human embryonic stem cells is now in a quandary. The ones I've talked to so far say they're waiting for word from the NIH about exactly what to do. In the meantime, some of them are continuing with their experiments anyway. Even in California, where researchers have access to all this, $3 billion of money from Proposition 71, they are still affected because they have to keep all that research separate from anything that's funded by the NIH. So in the Bush days, you had people with parallel labs so they could do their regular research in one lab and then their stem cell research in another lab where absolutely nothing was bought with a single penny from the NIH. A lot of that's been dismantled since Obama came into office, and now they face the prospect of having to do that again.
The NIH, of course, the National Institutes of Health,
right.
Have they had anything to say as yet?
No. So far, they're referring all comments to the Justice Department, which is representing them in the case, and the Justice Department is still trying to make sense of this ruling like the rest of us.
What do those who are engaged in this kind of research say that it will accomplish?
On the one hand, many people who are working on embryonic stem cells also work on adult stem cells, and one person I talked to noted the irony that a lot of progress on adult stem cell research is going to stop, too, because they learn a lot about that by studying human embryonic stem cells. But there's two main reasons scientists like them. For one, they have the ability to grow into any kind of tissue type in the body, and so it allows them to make tissues in dishes that allow them to study all kinds of diseases that you couldn't really study in a person. And then there's also another group, a whole subset of researchers who are trying to grow these cells into replacement tissues that you could use to treat people, for instance, with spinal cord injuries by giving them new motor new cells in their spinal cord and things like that.
Okay, obviously an enormously important issue. I don't know quite where to focus here. There's so much going for it, and we'll just have to see how it evolves and whether or not major amounts of research are slowed down. Karen Kaplan, it's good to have you with us, Los Angeles Times science reporter.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, what comes after the Great Recession on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. Forget the argument about the stimulus and the deficit. We're having the wrong conversation. That's according to Richard Florida, who says we need to blow up the fundamentals of our economy. He's a professor at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto and author of the book The Great Reset. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Let's start with the Great Reset. What do you mean by that? And is the Great Recession, as we call it, time for one?
Well, when the economic crisis hit, I was able to go back and look at the previous two analogous events. Obviously, the Great Depression of 1929 and the 1930s, and then the Panic and Long Depression of 1873 and thereafter. And what I was able to glean from that was three key things that I think are really important and comments that have been made but need to be inserted into our conversation. One is that these are really long-term processes. The average duration of one of these economic crises or resets is 2 to 3 decades from start to finish. So they're not short-term processes. They're very different than average business cycles. And the way out of them involves two components. The first tends to be relatively well understood by economists and historians, and that involves major new waves of innovation, as occurred in the 1880s and again in the 1930s, with Alexander Field has noted, was the most technologically progressive decade of the 20th century, far outdistancing the 1990s and 2000s. Improvements in productivity and efficiency, and big upgrades in human capital and massive changes in our educational system. But the third factor is the one that's been missing from the conversation. Not only to improve our productivity and innovation and upgrade our human capital, a big component of what has helped the United States recover from recessions or economic crises and undergird prosperity was dramatic shifts in the way we live and in our geography. The shift from an agrarian nation to an urban industrial nation in the late 19th century, and the shift from just an urban to a suburban nation in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And I think that's been underemphasized. And in order to begin to think about the ways we can reset and recover and enjoy a new round of prosperity, it not only is enough to improve our productivity, stimulate our economy, we're going to have to once again change how and where and the way we live.
Can you be specific? What kinds of changes do you anticipate?
Well, first, by way of historical analogy, I mean, there's a lot of conversation about what got us out of the Depression. Was it New Deal spending? Was it rising working class wages? A new social compact? Was it military mobilization? But the one thing that gets forgotten in that conversation is that what really stimulated the United States economy after the Depression and the war was what I would call simply a form of geographic Keynesianism, a set of public policies which mobilized and encouraged suburban home ownership, which fueled demand for the products coming out of U.S. factories. When you bought a house, you had to fill it up with, you had to buy a car, refrigerator, washer, dryer, appliances, television, and whatnot. Today, in order to fuel our economy again, I think it's not only enough to provide stimulus. In fact, I think we've been propping up our housing market and auto industry far too much, our mortgage finance system. We're going to have to create a new way of life which makes housing and cars and energy more efficient, less of a dramatic part of a consumer spending bill or household spending. I think it's anywhere from 55 to 75% of household income are spent on those things. And we have to free up space to consume all of the items that are being driven by a more technology or knowledge-driven economy. So we're going to have to shift the way Americans consume, not only increase productivity, if we're going to open up demand and spur the development of new technologies, more development in new industries.
What kind of new technologies do you think are going to be needed?
Well, I think what we've seen over the past 20 or 30 years is the development of a whole series of new leading-edge industries. And on the one hand, those are self-evident: software, information technology, biotechnology, robotics, productivity-improving technologies used in our factories, and a whole range of healthcare and biotech and biomedical technologies. I think the other wave of industries that we talk far less about are industries which are much more experiential and entertainment-driven. So the rise of artistic, culturally creative industries, and then a whole set of industries that are related to more holistic health and personal development, everything from personal coaching to personal training to better food, nutritionism, and all of that sort of thing. So I think the U.S. industrial structure, as far as I can see, looking at this in pretty great detail, has evolved not only away from a manufacturing to a service-based industry, but to a knowledge and creative industry. Now the point that others have talked about, and I think is absolutely apt, is that what's really terrifying about this, abjectly terrifying, is that our economic structure is becoming almost entirely bifurcated. So we're generating, on the one hand, a reasonable number of high-paying, high-skill, knowledge, high human capital, creative jobs, but we're generating an equal or slightly greater number of relatively low-skill and terribly low-paying, insecure, financially unstable jobs in kind of routine services. And one of the points I think that is just exceptionally important to put on the table of our national dialogue, and I've seen this get absolutely no traction in Washington, is that there's only one way out of this. A century ago, or 60 or 70 years ago, we turned manufacturing jobs from bad, low-paying jobs into good jobs. We did that through a variety of techniques. The only way we're going to stop this bifurcation, because we can't educate everyone and upskill everyone into high-paying knowledge jobs, is we're going to have to make an effort to transition a goodly portion of the 60 million service jobs, low-wage, insecure, financially unstable jobs we have. We're going to have to figure out a way to turn them into good jobs. We did it before in manufacturing. We're going to have to try to do it again now with services.
Very quickly, if you can, how did we do it before with manufacturing jobs, blue-collar jobs that were dirty and difficult and dangerous?
Well, remember Henry Ford saying that in order to sell cars, he had to pay his workers a $5 day. If he didn't pay his workers a $5 day, nobody could afford a car. So what happened was, of course, there was a whole series of groundswell efforts on part of workers to organize themselves into unions. Federal policy like the Wagner Act, which gave workers the right to organize and bargain collectively. And then I think a massive effort during the Depression and during the war to figure out a new social compact with hinged wages, at least for a good percentage of our manufacturing workers, the productivity improvements. But most importantly, we were able to channel improvements in productivity, innovations in the factory floor, into higher wages for workers. When it comes to service work today, I think that's the key element. We're going to have to begin to see service workers in low-end routine jobs much more like we see manufacturing workers on our factory floors. And I think one of the great successes that we forget in America is that we revolutionized our factories under the pressure of Japanese and German competition in the 1980s and 1990s. And our factories, the ones that remain, are humming along and are hyper-efficient and are in many ways models for the world and leading-edge manufacturers. I think the last great frontier of inefficiency in the U.S. economy is in this terribly underutilized and inefficient service sector. And in order to improve our economy and to improve wages in that sector, we're going to have to see workers as an asset, engage them in continuous improvement, engage them and attach them and engage them in their work, and see them as a source of productivity and innovation. And that's the only way I can think that we can begin to move forward and improve wages in that sector.
Richard Florida, author of the book Reset, and a professor of management at the University of Toronto. David Leonard is economics columnist at the New York Times. He's a staff writer for the paper and for the New York Times Magazine. Good to have you back on our program.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Professor Florida says he sees no evidence in Washington that there's any movement at all in the direction he thinks we need to go. What do you think, first about the direction, and secondly about whether it's on the radar screen in Washington?
I'm happy to be cynical about Washington, and we may get a chance to get into that. I do, though, think that parts of this are on the radar screen. I think that one of the reasons that the United States economy accomplished this incredible productivity revolution in blue-collar jobs was that we were the first country in the world that made a high school education something that was for the masses. When we were beginning to do this in the early 20th century, there were countries in Europe that looked at us and said, that's a waste. A high school education is wasted on the common person, and they're not going to be able to use it. And we went to this universal high school model, and it paid enormous dividends. And some of those dividends it paid were in the blue-collar jobs. Larry Katz and Claudia Golden have written a book about this called The Race Between Education and Technology. And one of the things that they discovered as they dug into fairly fine-grained data, as well as the big stuff, was that you see in places that moved ahead in education, you see their companies getting more productive. And that really shouldn't be any kind of mystery, right? I mean, education, when it's done well, is about learning how to do new things and learning how to do existing things better. And so when you had more educated workers, what that meant is that not only the clerical jobs, but also the blue-collar jobs, the people in those jobs were able to be more productive. And so you built these great companies, the Caterpillars, the GMs, you name it. And so I actually do think that in terms of the long-term issues, Washington has made an enormous amount of progress on education in the last year. We can't be guaranteed yet that it's going to work. And in fairness, a lot of the progress has been states responding to the Race to the Top program. But we've really seen huge, huge changes in education on the federal and the local level. And there are reasons to hope, at least, that they are going to pay some kinds of long-term dividends. Now, it is true that they won't pay short-term dividends. They will not put back to work the 15 million people who are now unemployed. And that's where Washington is really paralyzed. It hasn't figured out how to take further steps to help the economy in the short term, even though on some of the long-term stuff, I actually think it's been one of the success stories of recent months.
David Leonard of the New York Times. Richard Florida, back to you. Is progress, even if there is progress on education, enough to make the kinds of changes that you're looking for?
Well, I first of all, I want to echo David's comments and also the importance of the Goldens and Katz work, which when Alexander Field looked at that work again, he looked at a combination of the improvements in education in tandem with improvements in productivity and innovation as they work together. Both worked hand in hand, improvements in human capital and education, a round of innovation to power prosperity. But here's what I was able to uncover looking back at these two previous resets, again, the 1870s and 80s, the 1930s and 40s. The changes we made in education were massive. During the first Great Reset, we basically invented mass public education. Now, that was typically grade school education, grades 1, 2, 3, 4, to provide basic literacy and fluency in the three R's and to tool up our immigrants for the work in those earliest factories. My dad, who was born in 1921, was a product of that. He got a seventh grade education, but he had to quit school at age 13 to take up work in a factory. During the Depression, for those kids who were a little bit younger than my dad, we made a massive improvement in high school education, as David aptly points out, and Golden and Katz go into. We also, after the war, massively expanded with the GI Bill our college and university education. My dad tells a story of being an infantry soldier in the medical school, he would tell me, and they said, you know, we want to send you back to school to become a medical doctor, assuming he had a high school education, because he proved facile at that. And he said, I can't go back to school. I only have a seventh grade education. Well, he made him an education parent for myself and my brother. But the point is, the retooling of education we need now for a knowledge-driven and a creative economy makes what happened in the first reset, the emergence of a new schooling, public schooling system, and the second reset, the expansion of high school education and the GI Bill, look small by comparison. The effort we need for human capital upgrading far exceeds anything most people, aside from perhaps Bill Gates and others at the frontier of this debate. We need to completely remake our educational system, and it can be remade in ways that focus on individualized learning, lifelong learning. We know that our school system is a giant creativity squelching machine. So the point I'm trying to make is, if we're going to reimagine this system, it has to be done at a far grander scale than I currently hear the debate being articulated in Washington.
Let me, before we go to a break, introduce another guest, Robert Polin, who's professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He studies the economics of building a clean energy economy in the United States. And Professor Polin, good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much, Warren.
Let me go back to the very beginning when we heard the phrase geographic Keynesianism. What about consumer spending in all of this? And what about the millions that are unemployed now? If what we're hearing is more about the long term, what about the short term?
Well, any kind of Keynesianism right now, in my view, is superior to kind of the ascendant austerity arguments that are being made. President Obama introduced this commission on the fiscal deficit that's supposed to deliver its results in December, but the two co-chairs of the commission have already said that the fiscal deficit is a cancer on the economy and needs to be closed. So by Keynesianism we mean direct aggressive measures to promote job creation in the short term, I am strongly in favor of that. And I don't see those, by the way, as being in any way inconsistent with what Professor Florida was talking about. I will say one thing quickly, though. The one thing he left off, which I think is probably, in my view, the central transformation that needs to take place over the next generation, is building a clean, green economy. And that, in my view, also has very strong positive short-term elements in terms of job creation and investing in innovation, as well as the long-term output of fighting global climate change.
Okay, we have a lot to talk about, and we'll do so with our current guests, also Mark Zandi, chief economist of Moody's Analytics, when we come back after we take a very brief break. On Reporter's Notebook, are interest rates on credit cards going in the wrong direction? Tell us what you think about To the Point on our Facebook page. Back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Onlybeck with To the Point. I suppose you could say we're talking about reimagining the economy in the aftermath of the Great Recession. Robert Polin is professor of economics at University of Massachusetts at Amherst. When we began this program, we talked about with Richard Florida, who believes that it is old news and old-time thinking to worry about the deficit. And yet, Robert Polin, you say that's exactly what's happening with the Obama Commission. What's wrong with it, in your opinion?
What's wrong with it, Warren, in my view, is that we are far from having achieved a sustainable economic recovery. And as such, all of the forces that we have in play, economic policy tools, need to be concentrated on building and sustaining a recovery. And the more we think instead about setting deficit reduction as our priority on cutting, we are going to face the possibility of a double-dip recession, as they are experiencing now in Great Britain and Greece, precisely because they placed austerity and budget cutting ahead of a recovery.
So what should we be spending the money on?
Well, the deficit is a problem. I don't want to say the deficit is not a problem. And as I see it, the primary short-term issue is not the deficit per se, but that the credit markets are locked up. The banks are sitting on $1 trillion of cash reserves, whereas 3 years ago they held about $20 billion in cash reserves, so that we need policies to move credit back into the private sector. So it doesn't. I'm not thinking about a strictly government spending-led recovery. We need government spending to continue to sustain state and local governments, as I think your other guest, Mr. Zandi, has made the point often. Promoting state and local spending is one of the strongest multipliers, job creators, that we can introduce now, and we have to sustain that. But we also then have to get the private sector to lend, invest, and create jobs.
Mark Zandi now has been introduced twice and yet not heard from, a chief economist of Moody's Analytics. Always good to have you with our, on our program.
You.
Thanks a lot for being here. So how do you get the banks to loosen up? And is that, in the short term, the most important thing of all?
To get the banks to loosen up on credit.
Yeah.
The availability of credit. Well, I think that's just going to take a bit of time. I think the large banks, the big bank holding companies, are now very well capitalized, and they can lend, but they're very reluctant to, and will remain so until unemployment has definitively peaked and house prices have clearly started to rise, and we're not there yet. So we've got a bit of a chicken and egg kind of problem in the banking system, and I think it's just going to take time for them to get their groove back, get the confidence necessary to go out and start to extend credit. Now, there is a bit of good news on that front. I do think it's fair to say that the credit spigot, which has been very tightly closed for quite some time, is starting to open a little bit. So we are starting to see some credit flow a little bit more freely. But I think it's just going to take time before banks feel more comfortable to and get out there lending more aggressively.
You said chicken and egg. There's a catch-22 here, isn't there? If the banks are reluctant to lend, isn't the lending what's going to start the economy going and create the jobs?
Yeah, you said it just very, very nicely. And there's a lot of kind of chicken-egg problems in our economy right now. But I think that goes to a broader point, and that is, the economy is in recovery. Things have improved measurably from where they were a year ago, but they're not improving as fast as anyone would like, and I don't think they will. I think this is going to be a bit of a slog. We're not going to come roaring out of the gates. It's just going to take time for us to really get going here.
Richard Florida said earlier that what he calls these resets sometimes take two or three decades. Are you essentially saying the same thing?
No, I don't think it's take two or three decades. I think it'll take another year, two or three, before we're off and running. But I do think it'll take a lot longer than that to recover all of the jobs, the 8.4 million jobs that we lost in the recession, and it'll take a lot longer than that to get unemployment back down to where we consider it to be full employment. So I don't think it's decades. I think it's years, but years in the context of 9.5% unemployment is pretty uncomfortable.
Do you agree that the new jobs are going to have to look very different from the old jobs? Is it going to be necessary, for example, to take people in the service economy and effectively create a new middle class?
Yeah, it will look different, but I think what the jobs will look like is coming into view. I think we are focused, and the administration and policymakers are focused on the right thing, and that is trying to sell what we produce to fast-growing countries overseas, emerging economies where there are young populations and emerging classes, and the people there desperately want to raise their standard of living, and they're going to consume lots of different things, and we're going to produce the things that they want to consume. And I'm much more optimistic in this regard, or I am optimistic in this regard. I think if you're a U.S. manufacturer or a U.S. service company that survived what we just went through, you've got to be doing something right. You have to be very, very productive. You have to have a market niche. And I think as these emerging economies grow and develop, we will be able to successfully sell into them. And we'll be selling things that we all understand and know, things, aircraft and machine tools and computer equipment, sophisticated materials. But it also will be services. We're really good at producing accounting, legal services, engineering, architectural design, management consulting. I'm an economist, and most of my work now is selling into Asia, South America, and in parts of Europe. Even financial services, may I dare say. So I do think we are well positioned. It's not going to happen next month or even within a year, but I think over the course of the next several years, we will be selling more overseas, and that's where the growth and where the jobs are going to come from.
Mark Zandi, the chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Back to Professor Poland at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. You're focused on the clean energy economy. That's quite different from exports.
Well, there is a huge component of international trade connected to the clean energy economy, Warren. In fact, this is one of the issues that the development of manufacturing capacity and building wind energy, solar energy, and so forth, it's well known that other countries, Germany, Spain, China, Japan, Korea, are way ahead of us, and that we are importing even some of the things that are part of the stimulus program in terms of manufacturing components are being imported because we don't produce them. So one of the things, if we want to talk about kind of the, merging the long-term vision with the short-term needs, is to get the industrial policy right that will promote manufacturing development in clean energy, which I think picks up strongly on the theme that Professor Florida was talking about. I mean, what could be more creative over the long term than the transformation of our fundamental economic base from fossil fuel-driven economy to a clean energy economy? And let's build the manufacturing capacity here. There's a generation of work to be done to achieve that, and it can't be done strictly on the basis of the free market. Just as all the major technical innovations of the last century, the jet engine, aviation, computers, internet, were all subsidized primarily by the Defense Department, and then they were delivered to the market. And that's the kind of industrial policy that I think that we need that would advance new creative activities, new jobs throughout the economy.
Let me go back to David Leonard, the economics columnist at the New York Times and staff writer at the New York Times magazine. You said, pardon me, you said earlier that you'd be willing to discuss your cynicism about what's going on in Washington. Let me give you a chance to do it.
Well, it does have to do with these short-term issues. I am worried about the deficit over the long term. I think we've made a whole bunch of promises on, mainly on health care and Medicare, that we can't afford to keep. People are expecting larger benefits than they've paid in taxes for those benefits. And we've got the baby boom coming, which exacerbates the problem. So I think it's absolutely right for us to be thinking about the long-term deficit. I think it's serious. I think solving it needs to involve cuts to Medicare, cuts to Social Security, cuts to military. It needs to involve higher taxes. It needs to involve all sorts of things that voters basically at this point are against. But that doesn't change the fact that the economy still is too weak in the short term, and spending money in the short term to try to improve it doesn't materially affect our long-term deficit. That is just a much different problem in terms of size and timing. And so the idea that the Senate and the House, well, that's actually not fair to the House, the idea that the Senate has been frozen and hasn't really done anything to encourage more economic activity, I think is really disappointing. I think there are a lot of reasons for it. I think one is that for reasonable strategic reasons, the Republicans have decided not to cooperate. I think another is that some of the Democrats, the swing Democrats, are from states like Nebraska and other parts of the middle of the country that are actually quite healthy right now relative to the rest of the country, and so they are not as worried about the condition of the economy. And I think it's hard sometimes to see the effect, but today's news on housing numbers are actually yet another reminder of how the stimulus program did make a big difference. The reason we've seen this huge plunge in home sales in July is that the tax credit for home sales expired. And so it's a reminder that when the government wants to give people incentives to spend money, whether it's companies or consumers, it can make a difference. And the big stimulus bill wasn't big enough to get the economy healthy again, and it's running out now. And Congress has done little things, but Mark Zandi's talked about this a lot. There really is no form of stimulus that's more effective than aid to states, and Congress hasn't done enough of that.
David Leonard at the New York Times. Let me go back to Richard Florida, our first guest, author of the book The Great Reset, and professor at the University of Toronto. Let's talk, in the remaining time that we have, about some broader ideas that you have, particularly having to do with the regions of the United States. Which ones are likely to continue to decline? Which ones are likely to come out of the recession sooner? And what might be done about them?
Well, I think that it's pretty obvious, just as our job market has divided and become bifurcated, that job market is embedded in a geography. And the places those industries, whether it's the San Francisco Bay Area in technology or Los Angeles, a diverse economy, but with a specialization in media and entertainment, obviously this area, the Boston, New York, Washington, Boswash corridor, and particularly Greater Washington, D.C., which looks like a different version, a very different place than the traditional U.S. economy, and then perhaps the oil and natural resource producing belt of the economy, are enormously advantaged vis-a-vis the rest of the economy. And the places that have paid the biggest price, of course, are those old Rust Belt regions and towns that were hinged to perhaps single industries, or the Sun Belt, which really thought it could grow, parts of the Sun Belt, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Miami, by building homes, a kind of a gigantic real estate, a Ponzi scheme. But I want to say this, because I don't want this to be misinterpreted. Even with all the locational advantages in the world, states and localities could still do better or worse. And let me give you two examples that are close to my heart. One is the city of my birth, Newark, New Jersey. You couldn't imagine a city, although it has much better, terrific mayoral leadership now, with a better locational endowment. It is in the heart of the New York Metro. It's part of the Boswash Corridor, but it's one of the worst performing, poorest metropolitan areas, urban areas in the country. On the other hand, let's take a look at another place, Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I've just crunched all sorts of numbers about job growth, human capital levels, forecasted housing prices. Detroit is one of our economic basket cases. My wife is from that region. We travel there very often. I was, in fact, listening to Mark Zandi on another public radio station just recently, driving back from Detroit to Toronto. But Ann Arbor and many college towns, Madison, Wisconsin, Iowa City, Iowa, they have characteristics which make them look more like a Silicon Valley or Washington, D.C. than other Frost Belt centers. And I will add, having lived in Toronto, that being situated in the Great Lakes region, that where it's cold in the winter and snows a lot across the lake from Buffalo, you can have quite a diverse, well-functioning economy. So the point I want to make is there are certain geographic areas that have enormous advantages because of their economic structures and all of these other things, transition to different kinds of economies. But even with advantages or disadvantages, smart local policy can make a big difference, and no region is doomed to decline.
So, Mark Zandi, that would get us back, it would seem to me, to federal help to the states and other localities. What are the prospects for that?
Well, Congress just passed $26 billion more for state governments, which is helpful. Their problems, though, are much larger than that. By my estimate, the budget hole for the current fiscal year for state and local governments is well over $100 billion. So $26 billion is helpful, but the hole is quite large. And it's one of the reasons why the job market is having trouble and will continue to have some difficulty over the next 6-12 months, because state and local governments are the largest employer in the country, and they're going to be laying off lots of workers.
Is there concern in Washington that if you give the states and localities money, they won't know how to use it, or they won't use it as effectively as they should?
Yes. And, you know, more broadly, the concern is that the states are bloated, local governments are inefficient, they need to restructure, get their house in order. And, you know, I sympathize with that argument. I mean, I think there's a lot of efficiencies that could be had, and the state and local government should work on that. But the budget holes go much, much deeper than that, and these state and local governments are cutting into real programs that matter to lots of people. And I think it would be prudent for the federal government, for Congress and administration, to provide more help.
What regions seem to be the most likely to suffer the most, perhaps even have a double recession?
Well, I think it's the states that are still struggling with the housing market. David mentioned today's home sales numbers, which highlight that the housing market remains very, very fragile. And I suspect we're going to see more foreclosure sales and more house price declines. So that would include states like Florida, Arizona, Nevada, Central Valley of California, parts of the Midwest that Professor Florida mentioned. So those would be the areas where I suspect if we're going to have a double dip, they'll suffer it first and feel it most severely.
Richard Florida, in the interest of the long-term outlook, is home ownership, should it continue to be the source of individual wealth that it has been in the current economy?
Well, I think home ownership is great for people who have stable jobs. They know they want to stay in a given place. And can afford it. I think the bigger problem is that the U.S. has massively distorted our economy towards home ownership. And my only argument would be take the distortions out of the way. I mean, the subsidies for mortgage interest tax credits. I heard what Mark had to say last week on this, and I tend to agree with him in the short run. The subsidies to the secondary market institutions, which look like at least they're being discussed in Washington, D.C., this massive subsidy, which, and never mind the infrastructure subsidies that did all of the, that caused all of the problems that, that Professor Pollan has talked about with our energy regime. But I think the first thing we can do is take the distortions out of the market and let the free market work. I will note one thing, and I'd like to hear what others and Mark and others have to say about this, in terms of the length of time it will take to get out of this economic mess we're in. Alexander Field, in his paper on the Great Depression, noted it took 24 years for the housing market to recover after the crash of 1929. Now, I did not check Dean Baker's statistics, but I noted yesterday that he had found that, according to his projections, it will take 20 years for the housing market to make up the lost value in the current crisis. Now, 20 years is a little bit less than 24, and I certainly hope with our tools of macroeconomic management, what we're able to do to stave off the absolute terror of the economic and financial collapse and to restore some order to our economy, I hope we can accelerate it. But I do think we're only in the early phases of this recovery and reset. I don't think, even though the economy looks like it's ticked up, I don't think we're anywhere near a stable long-term prosperity regime. And I thought that notion that it would take 20 years for a housing market to recover at its current pace, it struck me as one indication that we should be thinking a little bit longer term rather than, you know, maybe the recovery is in the next couple of years.
Unfortunately, we don't have time for everybody to comment on that. Let me get as many in as I can. Robert Pollan, back to you at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Final word?
Quick point. I don't think that we're going to see the housing market look the way it is, and we don't need it to recover to where it was because we had a bubble. What we need is, returning to a stable system of housing, including home ownership and rental, that runs on stable prices. And in that case, we don't need to think about a 20-year recovery.
Mark Zandi?
Yeah, I think I'd agree. I don't know that getting back to the previous house price peak would be a particularly important accomplishment. I think the most important thing is jobs and getting those jobs back that we lost and getting unemployment down. And I'm more optimistic in that regard. I think it's going to take us 3-5 years. That's obviously a very long time, particularly for people who are unemployed. But I think that's how long it's going to take us to get us back to where we were with respect to what matters most for people, and that's employment.
David Leonard, do you think you'll be any less cynical about Washington after the election?
I don't know. I would say that although things have frozen in advance of the election, for better or worse, depending on your political orientation, Washington has gotten a lot done recently. I mean, there's all the education stuff, there's the healthcare bill, there's the financial re-regulation, and so I think there was a time this year in which it was possible to say, boy, Washington will never get anything done. I think now you can have a little more optimism than that, although if you think about some of our long-term problems, like the deficit, I would put climate change at the top of the list. I do worry that it will take a crisis like the financial crisis, but this time a different kind of crisis with climate or with the deficit, in order to get Washington to act, because these slow-boiling problems are often difficult for democracies to deal with.
Okay, we've ranged over a lot of different topics. Thank you all so much. David Leonard with the New York Times, Richard Florida, The Great Reset at the University of Toronto, Robert Pollan at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and Mark Zandi, Chief Economist of Moody's Analytics. Good to have all of you on our program. Interest rates for the U.S. Treasury, business firms, and home buyers are going down. But despite new laws and regulations, the rate for credit card borrowing are going up. We'll find out what's behind that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. New laws limit the ability of banks to increase rates on people who get behind on their credit cards. The response of the credit card companies is to increase rates on everybody. The Wall Street Journal reports that rates are at their highest level in 9 years, an average of 14.7%. The prime rate, 3.25%. Kelly Grant is Senior Consumer Reporter for SmartMoney.com. And Kelly Grant, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Is this a response, direct response to the Credit Card Act?
In large part, it is, yes. A lot of the Card Act provisions, which were so helpful for consumers, have really limited card issuers' ability to raise your interest rate and tack on fees if you misbehave or if they just feel like it. So they're trying really to almost front load all of those fees and penalty rates so that if there's a problem down the line, that they're already in a position to profit from it.
Are they different one from another, or are they all doing the same thing at approximately the same rate?
There's going to be some variation from issuer to issuer. A lot of it is still based on a consumer's credit rating when they're applying for a card and when the issuer is reassessing their accounts. But largely, you are just seeing rates go up across the board.
So if that's the case, did we really get consumer protection when the Card Act passed?
Well, if you are the type of consumer who is paying off your bill in full every month, then you know these rates are going to have limited impact on you. And the argument for the rest of us is that at least we are aware now through full disclosure of what the cost of that credit is going to be.
Do you think this is going to change the behavior of people who have credit cards? Will fewer of them subscribe?
I would hope so, actually, because we've seen in recent years credit card companies have been very keen to push us to use our credit cards everywhere. That's why you see so many of them offering rewards for everyday purchases and why you see, you know, things like credit card kiosks at McDonald's. So hopefully knowing the cost of the credit and seeing that, you know, they're going to be paying huge interest charges if they carry a balance, hopefully this will make consumers a little more aware of how they use their credit cards and have them using debit and cash when it's an option and being cautious about only spending what they can pay off each month.
What did the Card Act do to encourage or to establish a greater awareness on the part of people who have credit cards?
Well, the part of it is that the fine print is supposed to be in plain language, but the really big thing that consumers are noticing is that there's a cost of credit box essentially on your statement that shows you if you pay just the minimum, how much interest you'll pay and how long it will take you to pay off that debt. And what we're hearing from consumers is that that's really eye-opening to see that even just a small balance, if they are, you know, just paying the minimum on that, that they're going to spend decades even paying that off and spending hundreds of thousands or thousands of dollars in interest.
What else do you hear from consumers?
We're hearing that they are a little more satisfied with their credit card this year than they were last year before the Card Act went into play, and that comes in from a study from J.D. Power and Associates, but that they're actually a little bit less loyal to their credit cards. They're feeling less loyal. So the good thing here is that consumers are taking all of this information that's come out through the Credit Card Act, and they are hunting for the best card for their circumstance. So there is that possibility that consumers are going to save a little bit of money here and get their finances on track.
So have the new rules then generated the kind of consumer protection that you and others were hoping for, or are we seeing that they didn't go far enough, or that you can't ever be perfect?
I think it can't ever be perfect. No matter what we come up with, the credit card issuers are going to find some way to get around it. But it did help in a lot of ways, at the very least making consumers more aware up front when they're applying for a credit card or just even getting their statement that they understand the full cost of the credit. And some of the other good things were last year, we had reported on a lot of credit card issuers that were actually dropping consumers' credit lines below their existing balances. That's something that the Card Act has protected people from, and you can now determine whether you want to let a charge put you over your credit limit, or you can just have it declined, and that's certainly something that's helpful for people.
Is it? Are the banks, do you think, making a mistake, the credit card issuers making a mistake? Might this all end up backfiring on them?
This could, but I think most people who are ending up leaving their credit card, they're just picking a different card that may have more favorable terms. So this should in some ways balance out as the credit card issuers see where consumers are going and how they're changing their behavior. They'll have to change the cards along with it if they want to stay in business, and certainly they do.
If you want to shop around, what do you look for?
Well, the first thing, obviously, is a favorable interest rate. Even if you're not planning on carrying a balance, that's something to look for. Annual fees are something that we've seen popping up post-Card Act. And if you can, you really want to avoid that. Most of the time, any benefit that would come with such a card, usually there's better rewards. It's just not worth the fee for most consumers. So low interest rate, steering clear of the annual fee, and then just any other rewards if you are someone who's paying off your balance in full every month. And there's some great websites out there. One that we like is BillShrink.com, and that'll help you find a great credit card for whatever your situation is.
BillShrink.com, spelled like it sounds.
Exactly.
Kelly Grant, Senior Consumer Reporter at SmartMoney.com. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Daryl Satzman and Karen Radziner, our Technical Director Mike Newport. Email us. Share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/to the point. Check us out on Facebook. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.